All right, let's get started. Our first speaker is Niven Postma. She is a strategy, leadership, and cultural consultant partnering with clients in diverse industries around the world to reignite the discretionary energy of people and teams, build an enabling culture, and develop meaningful strategies. An expert in organizational projects, Niven is the author of the best-selling book, If You Don't Do Politics, Politics Will Do You, a guide to navigating office politics ethically and successfully, published in 2020. Her articles and ideas can be found in various well-respected media and podcasts. Niven is a Harvard Business Review contributor, a visiting lecturer at Henley Business School, and a part-time tutor at the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Niven has had a wide and varied executive career across multiple organizations and sectors, including the CEO of the Business Women's Association, CEO of NOAA, which is Nurturing Orphans of AIDS for Humanity, Head of External Strategy and Head of the SARB Academy at the South African Reserve Bank, and Head of Leadership and Culture for the Standard Bank Group. Her keynotes on organizational politics, leadership, culture, and women's leadership have been delivered to audiences of up to 60,000 people. Niven is a doctoral student and holds an executive MBA in systems thinking, human capital development, knowledge management, leadership and change. She is also a postgraduate diploma in future studies and a BA in English political science. Niven has been awarded the Archbishop de Tutu Leadership Fellowship in 2007. Niven has served as a reserve police officer for 2 years and is chairperson of the board at Cotlands. She lives in Johannesburg with her partner and gets to be the proud and happy aunt to 6 niblings in South Africa, Kenya, and New Zealand. Welcome, Niven, and thank you very much for joining us.
One of my CV, but it's very, very nice to be here along with Bricks and Northwest University, and it feels like half of Joburg. I don't know if there's enough parking in this hotel for everyone, but if you got parking, I'm delighted. So, the last time I gave a talk for the Actuarial Society, Wim Elst was still around, and for those of you who knew him, I'm sure his loss is keenly felt. I only met him a few times online, and I thought he was an extraordinary person. And so it's a funny feeling a year later to know what's the same in the world and what's different, but just an acknowledgement to a man who I really enjoyed and who I think represented the society really well. I want to talk to you about the context in which you work as highly, highly skilled technical people. And I do a lot of work with insurance companies in South Africa. I work with a lot of actuaries. I have friends who are actuaries. And I always say, you guys are the ones who were clever enough but didn't have the personality to become accountants, right? You really enjoyed that one. So, you know, this focus on the technical, the focus on the rational and the analytical. Gosh, I mean, in a world where hard skills are hard to come by and in a country where it feels like our biggest export is skilled taxpayers, people who actually have highly regarded, very impressive skills are people that I celebrate and I think we all need to hold on to. And yet, I think purely the technical is a challenge. And so let me talk to you about the things beyond the technical, including those people who are behind the pillar. Gosh, this is an interesting setup. All right, so I want to share with you 2 numbers. First one, 79%. Sadly, this is not the matric pass rate. It's also not the percentage you need to pass matric. What it is the result of this year's Gallup Global Engagement Survey. So this is a survey, that is done around the world, all manner of organizations, all levels, all countries, to measure the level of engagement of people in organizations. So the degree to which, you know, the wheel is not turning and the hamster is dead. People are actually coming to work and caring, giving a damn, engaging. 79%, sadly, ironically, given that this is a global engagement survey, is actually the amount of disengagement in the world. Disengagement. So for every rand you're paying in salaries, you're getting 21% back. Jeez, I did that quickly in my head. I thought, actuaries, I better have got that right. You're getting 21% or 21 cents return on every rand of salary. In real effort, discretionary and otherwise. And this disengagement can be both passive and active. So passive, people are just coming to work and going through the motions. Not really giving much of themselves, but not really, and kind of checking out. Active disengagement. It sounds perverse, and it is perverse, but it is real. People come to work, and they actively undermine the company that they work for. They actively undermine their teams. They actively undermine their colleagues. And like I said, it sounds perverse because it is, and yet there was a survey that was done in the States a few years ago where people were asked a question, and the answer was 47%. So the question was, would you forgo a substantial pay raise? Now, of course, substantial is relative and it's subjective. But would you forgo a substantial pay raise in return for seeing your immediate manager fired? 47% of people said yes. Wow. So that's one stat. 80% is the other stat I want to share with you. How many of you have heard of the concept of flow? Okay, a few people. So even if you haven't heard the concept, and it comes from an American-Hungarian psychologist called Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, even if you haven't heard the term, hopefully you've had the feeling. And it's that feeling of you're doing something, and man, it is so interesting and so absorbing and so wonderful that you actually lose track of time. And you kind of come out at the end of it. And it can be exercise, it can be your actuaries working with a pricing model. It can be reading a beautiful novel, listening to a magnificent piece of music, whatever it is. But that feeling of like, wow, this is what I was meant to be doing in the way that I was meant to be doing it, and time becomes irrelevant. So Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who coined that term, flow, to describe that state, in his work found that 80% of adults say that even if we were to become financially independent, you know, make a brilliant investment, win the lotto, get a great bequest, whatever, even if we were to become financially independent so we didn't need to work, 80% of us would still want to work. Because of course it's about paying the bills, but it's about so much more than that. It's about a sense of community, of connection, of contribution, of our skills, of doing something that matters, and that's hopefully more than just moving things from an inbox to an outbox. So for me, this is a fascinating dilemma and paradox. That somehow we have set up organizations that the vast majority of people, 79% of people around the world, are just dragging themselves through the damn day. Sometimes they're dragging themselves through their whole career. Because how we set up organizations, how we've set up all manner of things, and yet most of us actually want to work. We are wired to contribute. And this presentation is wired to do interesting things. And so all of my work, guys, this isn't forwarding, maybe you can help me and forward it. All of my work is about bridging this divide. This absolute irony, paradox, and to me, tragedy. And there's five things that I want to share with you about why I think a purely technical, analytical, rational way of looking at the world, which frankly is the way that most highly skilled people like yourselves look at the world, is necessary, but it's not sufficient. It's the same as when I was working at the Reserve. Okay, now you guys have just gone bananas. Okay, we've got to go right back. It's the same as when I was working at the Reserve Bank and the current governor, Lesetse Ganyago, stood up having just been appointed governor and he was speaking to all of the managers. And he said something very profound. For a highly technical, analytical man and a very impressive central bank governor. And he said, we have got to really think about the culture of this bank. And let me tell you, the Reserve Bank is an impressive place. I'm immensely proud to have worked there, and I always will be. But he said, we've got to think about the culture of this bank. And if one more person talks to me about soft skills, please, people, if they're so soft, why are they so damn hard to get right? Which, let me tell you, was about the closest that anyone's ever come to swearing at the Reserve Bank. So, if we can go back to my first slides. All right. So, I think there's five mistakes that most of us make. And I want to take you through them. And it's these mistakes that really pose risks in organizations. And when I was at the Reserve Bank, I had somebody come from the South African Institute of Risk Management, and I was hosting him, and I thought, ugh, I've got an hour of my life listening to talk about risk. I'll never get this hour back. You guys are deep risk experts. And in the work that I do with insurance companies, it's interesting how few people have heard this. So let me share it with you. He said, actually, there's two definitions, conceptually, intellectually, analytically, about risk. He said, of course, the first one is the one that we all know. It's the risk that bad things will happen. Mitigate all of the things that everyone does. He said, but there's a whole other category, an equal and opposite category that we never think about, we're not measured on, we don't hold ourselves accountable to. And it's the risk that good things will not happen. The counterfactual. So the risk of bad things happening, the risk of good things not happening, for me boil down to five things. The first one is, both of these start to become realized when we treat work like school. How many of us put our heads down, think if you work hard enough, somebody's going to notice and they're going to give you an A? Well, that's simple. Oh, you're laughing. I don't know if that's Rai or Rufel or... No, it's not you. But a lot of people do that, right? I've just written an article on it. The ways we treat work like school. Work is not school. Technical skills, as I said, are necessary. They're not sufficient to get that A. And how you define that A, of course, is personal. Of course, it's highly subjective. But the ignoring of the political realm and reality of organizations is one of the key ways that I have seen that people treat work like school. So, when I say politics, give me some words. Beg your pardon? Say that again? ANC, ugh, no. Let's not. Please, it's too early in the morning to have a drink, but the bar is just outside there, so I might after the session. Organizational politics, the kind of words we spit out. Give me some words. Cliques, thank you, beautiful. What else? Favoritism. Conflict. Debates, but more neutral. Arguments, not so neutral. Keep going. Departments or compartments? Departments that are compartments, yeah, sure. The silos in organizations. Never mind us and them, the competition, the us and them is internal. Absolutely. Give me one or two more words. If you don't give me a word, I'll ask you for one. Agenda, exactly. Agenda with a capital F, probably, right? Give me another word. Territory. Predatory. Territory. Lovely. What did you notice about these words? Any of them positive? No. Most of them terribly, horribly negative, right? Good news and the bad news is this happens every time I ask people about politics. Overwhelmingly, the words are negative. But this is actually the definition of politics, the definition that is most in use and that I'm using for my PhD. It's about the informal, it's the unofficial, it's the behind-the-scenes stuff that happens in every organization to get information, to give information, support, make things happen. What do you notice about this definition? It's positive. Yeah, or even if it's not positive, at least it's neutral, right? It can absolutely be positive. It can be negative. But it by itself is neutral. Do you recognize yourself in any of this stuff? Do you do any of this stuff? You're smiling and nodding. Tell me more. Oh, gosh. Oh, I shouldn't have sat in the front. It's like sitting in the front at a comedy club. It's such a bad mistake. Yeah, well, tough. It's too late now. You were smiling and nodding. So you do that. You use the informal. You use the unofficial. You maybe have the meeting before the meeting. You pick up the phone to get support. Yeah, shame. Your poor body language is like, oh, so. Okay. As soon as I finish, he's sitting in the back right over there. So this is the reality. Most of us do this, right? Most of us do this. We may not have called it politics. Fine. Don't call it politics. Call it whatever you want. Call it managing your stakeholders. Call it getting efficient in the informal space. I don't care what you call it. What I hope for is that you start to get better at it. And it's really like a billboard that I saw in Lagos. My sister and her husband and the kids lived there for a few years. And geez, I mean, Lagos is an interesting place, eh? My brother-in-law said, man, no, it's just like Joburg. But Joburg on crack. I'm like, yeah, you can say that again. Fascinating place. And I was stuck in the traffic, as you inevitably are when you go to Lagos. And there was this huge billboard that said, you're not in the traffic. You are the traffic. I'm like, that's so deep. It's the same with politics, okay? You are part of this, one way or another. And yet, it's about how it works for you or works against you. No, when it works for you, jeez, man, I was so strategic. It's when it works against you, it's that flipping politics. And then, of course, you've got everyone's attention and sympathy because everyone knows that it's only one thing. It's not only one thing. It is inevitable that you will have politics in your organization. Telling me that your organization has politics is like telling me that water is wet. Of course it has politics. It has people. What kind of politics it has, okay, this is up for discussion. Of course you can have hideous politics. I mean, I have heard some dreadful stories. Really, really heartbreaking stories of what bad politics can do to people, have done to people. But you can have perfectly ethical, legitimate ways of influencing the status quo, not just through the formal. Because you have to understand the reality that every organization, every team, every department has got two sides. Of course, it's got the formal. The delegations of authority, the organogram, the standard operating procedures, the, you know, you name it, budgetary allocations, whatever. But it always has the informal as well. And that stuff is not written down anywhere. Anywhere. You have to figure that stuff out. And choosing only to stay and play in the formal and to take that purely at face value as the only reality that you are navigating, well, that's your choice. But frankly, it's like choosing to play tennis on half the court, rugby on half the pitch, soccer on half the field. I mean, we can go on and on and on. There's always a formal and an informal side in organizations because what we're talking about here is a currency and a capital. And it's a currency and a capital, not like that, but of people. Okay, stuck again, guys. We're talking about your strategic relationships. There you go. Your strategic relationships, your power, your influence, and the reputation that you have, and what you have a reputation for. The more you have of political intelligence, the more you're going to build your capital, the more you're going to get things done. And not just for yourself. If it's all about you, you're a sociopath. It is about your team as well. I have just had a delegate say that she is leaving a manager that she really likes and respects, thinks is fantastic, but they cannot get anything done. Because this manager refuses to engage in the politics and the informal side of things. She can do it perfectly efficiently and ethically, but she refuses because the answer should speak for itself. My work should speak for itself. It does not. In an ideal world, again, come join me at the bar after my session. We can talk about how the world should be. In this world, the right answer is not enough. You need more. And so she is leaving this manager because she's not having the meetings before the meeting. She's not laying the groundwork to get things done. It's not just about you, it's about your team. It's about your stakeholders, it's about the people who are counting on you. The second thing that I think we do that contributes to this gap is we take the complexity of people, of systems, of life, of leadership, and we reduce them to either or instead of seeing the richness in the both and. Don't worry about nodding. I'm not going to ask you another question. You're looking very attentive. Yeah, you're petrified. I can feel it coming off of you in waves. It's not about either or with the critical things of life. It's about both and. Easy to say, much harder to make happen. So I've been in leadership positions since I was 11, which is hilarious. But I was head girl at junior school, and then it just, you know, it went downhill from there. Head girl at high school, ugh, at 16, blah, blah, blah. So I have had leadership positions for most of my life, not just most of my career. And when I was doing one of my postgrad studies, was prescribed this article from the Harvard Business Review. I was in my early 40s. And I'd never, ever, ever thought about this question. I'd certainly never been asked this question. And this is the question. Why should anyone be led by you? Jess, it got me very quiet and thinking very deeply about the why. Sure, I'd been elected. Sure, I'd been appointed. Sure, I'd been headhunted. But so what? Because, of course, there's a fundamental difference between compliance, people just complying with what you do, and people actively following you. Compliance is rational. Followership is emotional. And the two are not mutually exclusive, but they're not the same thing. So why should anyone be led by you? And one of the things they talk about in this article is the quality of tough empathy. Tough empathy. I learned that very early in my career when I was the CEO of an NGO in the RSA, the country of acronyms. CEO of an NGO looking after orphaned and vulnerable kids in this country. Now, when you have a million orphaned and vulnerable kids, they get reduced to an acronym as well. OVCs, Orphaned and Vulnerable Children. We looked after about 30,000 kids a day in Gauteng and rural KwaZulu-Natal. And let me tell you, the rage that I felt when I sat with a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old, who was living in a house that was falling to pieces, and he was raising his siblings because there were no adults left. When you sit in schools and you realize that those kids, and I mean, I'm speaking to people who may well have come from communities like this, who know these communities way better than I did in the years that I worked there. What I had to learn very quickly was that if I wasn't looking after these kids and the communities and the grandmothers and the extended family members who were trying their best to make things happen, if I didn't care deeply about these people and these kids, well, then I'd lost the plot. This was not a production line. This was not a widget factory. These were kids and people in desperate circumstances. But by the same token, I had funding from all over the world, including the US government. And just caring was not enough. If all I did was care while I was running a support group, I wasn't running a multi-million rand NGO. And this quality of tough empathy, I learned it in my early 30s, I've never forgotten it. You can, you have to, get both right. Anybody know who this is? No, you don't answer, man. Hey, who knows who that is? Yes, Martin Luther King. Yeah, it's great when you're so famous, people know you from the back of your head, right? He said it beautifully. Power without love is reckless and abusive. I can think of a few stronger words than that. But love without power is sentimental and anemic. You have to have both if you're going to show up as not just a credible leader, but as a halfway decent human being, particularly in this country where there's so much that needs doing. The third thing, I think HR is where culture goes to die. I made the mistake of saying that to a head of HR once. We don't have a great relationship, but I think it's true. And, you know, I think when we think about culture, we think about values and we think, oh, well, it's just those words on a wall. No. Values are critical, but they're not enough. What you need is a culture that takes values and makes them real. And when you've got resonance between your values and your culture, okay, we can talk. When you've got constant dissonance, well, it'll do people's heads in and do people's hearts in, which is why you've got that kind of disconnect of 79% and 80%. So what are the things you need beyond just values? Especially when there's interesting research that says you take away the value, you take away the name of a company on a value statement, and what's your name?
Eric.
Eric wouldn't be able to tell the difference between Eskom, SAB, SAA, SARS, because all the value statements are the same. They're completely motherhood and apple pie, non-controversial, blah, blah, blah. So what values are being chosen in your organization to achieve what strategy, and how are they being reinforced or not? First way is through the leadership behaviors. Okay, guys, just advance it, please. That is a great Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, over 100 years old. What you're doing speaks so loudly, I can't hear a word you're saying. You got values that say something and leaders are doing something completely different. It's a recipe for disaster. Second thing, hey, how many times I've seen this? No, we're building an ecosystem in this organization, really. But you're rewarding me for my individual contribution. You know where I'm going to take my cue from. Not what you say, what you pay me for. Are the two aligned? Most often they're not aligned. And the last one is the systems and processes. Geez, I sat with one of the banks, decent people, good people, cared very strongly about customer centricity. And then I sat in one of their branches and I watched this lovely woman at Hyde Park trying desperately to keep a smile on her face and give an answer to a client around what was going on with her account. And I thought, all the customer centricity talk in the world, when these are the systems and processes that your tellers are working with, and they've got three systems that don't talk to each other. Yes, of course we know the banks have got legacy systems and issues. But don't talk to me about customer centricity when this is what your people are working with, and it completely flies in the face of that. So same as with technical skills. Your values, necessary, not enough. The next one, A, this is my worst. When we take really critical, life-important things and we reduce them to acronyms or we reduce them to compliance issues. And aren't we brilliant at that in this country as well? But it's not just us. I'll get to us now. I don't even know how many B's and E's there are in BE anymore. I mean, I've lost track. But surely at the heart, what we're trying to do is recognize this reality, that diversity is a fact. But the equity and the inclusion and belonging, these are choices, they're outcomes. And please let's not make the mistake of thinking that diversity is only the superficial, the demographic. You can have a whole bunch of white male actuaries that can be highly diverse. Where did they grow up? How did they grow up? Some of them were too scared to go home because their parents were at each other's throats. Some of them had a sibling. They spent most of their childhood in hospital with that sibling. Diversity is, of course, the inherent things, but it's also the acquired things. There's two kinds of diversity. And you can change your experience of being human all through your life. You can start able-bodied and suddenly you have an accident and the next thing you're in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. Diversity is not just the demographics. Like I say, it's inherent and it's acquired all through our life. And this question of belonging, just we're terrible at it as human beings, particularly in this part of our history. The last 200 or 300 years of human history of capitalism. And let me tell you, I'm firmly a capitalist. I think money is an important, critical thing, and it makes life so much better. And it's not enough. So, let me show you these two pictures. There was a phenomenon in the American Wild West for over 200 years. I don't know who this Red Indian, and apparently that's now the correct term. It's not Native American, it's now still Red Indian again. I don't know who this red Indian bloke was. This is just a Google Images search. But I can tell you that he didn't stay like that. Why do I know that? Because there was a phenomenon, like I say, for 200 years, where as the West in the States was being conquered, colonized, whatever word you want to use, there were thousands of white people and red Indians who were kidnapped in raids and in battles. Probably tens of thousands, actually. And for 200 years, there was intense embarrassment on the part of white society. Because in all of that time, there was not a single Indian who, when they were given the choice to go back to being an Indian and living with their tribe, or staying in a white community, there was not a single Indian who chose to stay in a white community. And there were thousands of white people who chose to stay with Indians. It comes from work by Sebastian Younger, who was the war correspondent for Vanity Fair. And what he talks about is how we lost, in fundamental ways, a sense of belonging over 200 years ago in Western capitalist societies. Belonging is not just an acronym that comes out of HR. It's not just something from the Department of Labor. It's not just a feel-good thing. It is a fundamental need that over 200 years ago, we were already starting to lose. And then we think about this country and all these flipping reports that have to be given to government and jumping through hoops about numbers and ratios and targets as opposed to what are we trying to get right here and why does it matter? Why does it matter so much? So I'm going to read you a passage from Robert Sobukwe's biography. I've taken two separate years of sabbaticals. Friends of mine thought it was hilarious that I was calling them sabbaticals. They said, no, it's only a sabbatical if you're still employed. I'm like, yeah, but I'm choosing to be unemployed. It's different. I took a year off just to read. I was very close to burnout, and I thought, if I fall over that cliff of burnout, it's going to take a lot to put the pieces of me back together again. So I'm taking a step back. And I read over 200 books in a year. Out of those books, the two that stood out, one of them was Robert Sobukwe's biography, founder of the PAC, for those of you who don't know his background. So this is a passage from his book. Not written by him, written by Benjamin Pogrund, who is the editor of the Rand Daily Mail. Bureaucrats were also hard at work on the system that made enforcement of apartheid possible. Population registration. The law, initially introduced in 1950, was to ensure that every single South African was put into a defined racial pigeonhole. Each person was given an identity number, part of which was a racial classification. So 00 meant a white South African, 01 a colored, 02 a Malay, 04 a Chinese, 05 an Asian, down to a 09 for a Nama of Southwest Africa. Two sections, 06 for other Asian and 07 for other colored, provided for those who could not be fitted in elsewhere, a sort of miscellaneous of the human race. Those vital two digits were intended to and did affect life from birth to death, with every detail specified and fixed by law, in which hospital you could be born, in which suburb you could live, which house you could buy, which farm you could buy, which nursery school and school you could attend and which university or technical college, which cinemas and theatres you could go to, which buses, train compartments and taxis you could travel in, which bus stops, railway, pedestrian bridges and platforms you could use, which beach you could swim from, which municipal swimming pool you could use, from which library you could get books, which park bench you could sit on, in which restaurants you could eat, which lavatories you could use, in which hotels you could stay, whether you were allowed to enter a municipal hall, which jobs you could hold and how much you would earn, how much liquor you could buy and possess, who you could legally have sex with and who you could marry, how easily you could get a passport for travel abroad, how much your old age pension, disability, or war veterans pension would be, which sports fields you could use, and the quality of the facilities available to you, whether you could vote, which hospital you could go to, if you fell ill and which doctors and nurses would attend to you, which hearse you would be carried in when you died, and in which graveyard you would be buried. That's the context of this country, and we reduce something that profound that will sit with us for generations to flipping acronyms and compliance instead of a deep, deep need to fix things and get people to feel like they belong. And please, let's not talk about the ANC. And so, you know, this need is a human need. It has particular resonance in this country, given where we all come from. And we're not getting it right in so many places. This need to connect, this need to belong, this need to feel part of something. And then the last thing is forgetting what actually matters in life. My work matters immensely. I jump up every morning grateful to get to do the work that I do. And I remember running a strategy session with an executive team, an insurance team actually, just after COVID, and we were talking about innovation. So I thought, okay, as part of the check-in question, I'm going to ask them something that they'd done for the first time in lockdown. Because, you know, you kind of think about innovation with a capital I. No, innovation can happen all the time in every way. And we all had to be innovative in lockdown. My partner and I started up an alkulambulance from our house in Parkhurst. We had lots of wine, and we were the alkulambulance for anybody who needed wine. It was fantastic. We all became criminals. All broke the law. Is this being recorded? Okay. So I asked this team of execs, so tell me something you did for the first time in lockdown. And this one guy, this big man, looked at me and he says, when my gardener came back, I hugged him. He said, I don't know who was more surprised, me or my gardener. So I thought that was hilarious. But the second person that said something that really stuck with me was, he said, I met my wife. And I was like, aw, that's so lovely. In the disaster that was lockdown, you met the person you were going to marry. And then I was going all mushy. And then I looked at his face and I thought, no, hold on, there's more to the story. And I said, what's this actually about? And he said, no, you don't understand. I said, I clearly don't. He said, no, I've been married to my wife for 20 years. So the opportunity that comes to connect with the people that we love, the things that we love, who we are, this can't be underestimated. I had a friend, about 3 years ago, I had a complete nervous breakdown. One of my dearest and oldest friends. It was devastating to watch. And I was so impressed when she went to an occupational therapist. And the first thing that this person asked her was not, what's the matter with you? He asked her, what matters to you? And then through a series of discussions, she realized that every single thing that mattered to her in life was being completely trampled on, ignored, minimized in the work that she was doing. So of course something had to give, and it was her. What matters to you? And like I say, it really matters to me to be in this country. I spent 4 years backpacking after matric. I have a Dutch passport. If I wanted, I could get a British passport. I choose to be in this country because it matters. And the sense of community and belonging and identity in this country, even as I do work around the world, matters. And so I really hope that for all of you, there is a sense of meaning, of belonging, of identity, wherever you are, in whatever island of sanity you're able to build in the craziness of this country and of this world. And ultimately, Esther Perel is right. The quality of our relationships determine the quality of our lives. Forget that. And it doesn't matter whether it's the relationships at work or the relationships at home. There will be this mismatch between the 79 and 80%. Not just now, but for the rest of your career. So with that, thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Do we have any questions for Niven?
So get some awareness, start reading a bit more about it, and like I say, I've got a whole bunch of videos you can watch as well. The second thing is then assess yourself. Okay, so if this is what success looks like, and this is what it takes to be politically successful, how close or how far am I from that? Ton of exercises you can do in the workbook I've got up online. And then the third one is action. What are you going to do? What, so what, now what? What's your strategy? Where you are in that context with what you're trying to achieve at this point in your career with these people and these deliverables, how are you going to get effective and strategic around it? And again, you know, there's a whole exercise on how you can build a political strategy in that workbook. Yes?
I need to worm myself out of this hole. I might have been part of the 79% that was disengaged this morning, but...
I can't believe it.
Yeah.
So I get up, I shower, I put on lipstick, everything, and you're not even listening.
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
Just draw the connection between those statistics and the latter part of your presentation where you went into sort of history of Native American and our own country's obviously political history. I didn't quite see the connection there between the two. And maybe elaborate a bit more on that, if you may, please.
Sure. So I think my fundamental premise is that we've got a disconnect, as I said, between people who are disengaged but people who want to work. And one of the reasons that I think that happens is because something as fundamental and profound as belonging, as inclusion, is something that we think HR needs to sort out for the Department of Labor in numbers and in plans, as opposed to a profound human need to belong, to address things that are wrong, and a need that is bigger than just South Africa, hence the American story, but that has its particular nuances and ramifications in South Africa, and we have reduced it to tick box exercises that are done at best grudgingly and at worst resentfully, with all kinds of very valid reasons for that begrudging resentment. Does that make more sense?
Okay, last chance for any other questions. Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, Niven. Really appreciate you coming to speak to us. Thank you.